Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 11, where we will be talking with friends of the show who have seen the play The Cursed Child, either in London or New York. Come with me to live vicariously through their experiences. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I'm your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are you doing today, John?
You know, pretty doggone good. It's spring here in Oklahoma City. Life is good.
Very good. Starting to see the buds on the trees and everything over here.
Oh, it's nice.
Yeah. Well, listeners, you are in for a real treat today because our guests have all seen the play The Cursed Child, either in London or New York, and they are going to tell us all about their experiences. I'm so excited to be able to just get a little window on it, since I'm not sure when I would be able to go see that. Maybe you're in the same boat as me. I'm going to introduce each of our guests just in alphabetical order. And so first up today, we have Dr. Tracy Beeler, assistant professor in the Department of English at Borough of Manhattan Community College of the City University of New York. And she was our guest on the third podcast of Reading, Writing, Rolling, where we talked about oppression and subversion in the Harry Potter series. Welcome back to the show, Tracy.
Hello, Katie and John and my fellow panelists. I'm very excited to be back.
Excellent. Next, we are delighted to welcome to the show mystery novelist and massive Harry Potter fan, Dolores Gordon-Smith, author of the Jack Haldane classic mystery series set in 1920s England, one of my favorite eras of history. And she's just finished her 14th book. Welcome, Dolores.
Hello, and thank you very, very much for inviting me on the show. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. Now, Dolores is the mother of five daughters, all of them Harry Potter fans. A major parental achievement, I think.
And, absolutely, it was.
And they all went to the London show together. And so we are fortunate to have Dolores' daughter, Elspeth Gordon-Smith, joining us today as well. Elspeth is a film studies graduate and primary school teacher who loves sneaking Harry Potter references into her practice and even themed her latest job interview around Harry Potter. Welcome to the show, Elspeth.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We're also delighted to welcome to the show Heidi Tandy, who is the founder of Fiction Alley and longtime legal committee staffer for the Organization for Transformative Works, which is, as the website says, dedicated to preserving and archiving fanish voices. What a worthy cause. And welcome to the show to you too, Heidi.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for having me.
I want to break in here.
Yes.
Because Heidi Tandy is responsible for this show in large part because of she was a co-founder of Harry Potter Educational Fanon and the remarkable conventions from 2003 to 2012. I certainly wouldn't have become the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars except for the platform and the support and enthusiasm of those conventions and Heidi's work. So anyway, just a note
that
she's
awesome.
Doing wonderful. She's doing wonderful things today, but Heidi's history is phenomenal inside the fandom.
Just John, thank you so much.
An obligatory comment.
Well, and I have to say, like, I think that kind of fan work is so important. As a historian, you know, I do often think about how do we make sure that we're not going to lose these voices? How can we make sure they're archived?
Yeah, I think that honestly, and I don't want to jump ahead of some of the conversation we're going to be having, but every single time that there's new Harry Potter content sort of hitting the world, there becomes more things for the fans to write about and do art about and do, you know, talk about and all these different kinds of conversations. And that's why the archiving that we've done both with Fictionally and now with Archive of Our Own, we'll see what happens going forward, is just a fundamental way for people to be able to enjoy the stories they love from different kinds of perspectives. And in a lot of ways, that's what Cursed Child gets all of us to experience in person with a couple thousand of our closest friends.
I'm waiting for Katie to ask you if you think that Cursed Child is fan fiction.
No.
Katie, you're waiting.
Oh,
very good. Okay. No. Hey, that's cool. Okay. All right. I think we're going to have a conversation here, guys. That's pretty cool. All right. So two of you, Dolores and Elspeth, saw the show in London. And two of you, Tracy and Heidi, saw the show recently in New York. So let me ask you what your first encounter was with the play, The Cursed Child. Did you read it first before you saw it? And how did you actually score a ticket to one of the performances?
Yeah, I bought the book as soon as it came out because I couldn't wait to get my hands on it. And I must admit, I was actually disappointed with it. However, I stayed in the queue for tickets, but it was actually a friend of mine who's also a Harry Potter fan who was, I think she's got less to do than I have because she was able to stay on the internet for like a night and a day. And then she got right to the head of the queue and it went down. So she then rang up the theatre and said, you know, I've literally been waiting for something like 26 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
And they said, okay, you've got some tickets. And that's how it happened.
That's great. Persistent friends. Best kinds to have. So that's wonderful. So when did you see the play, Dolores and Elspeth?
Oh, goodness. When was it, Elspeth?
September. Last September. Bit of an epic journey because I had this job interview, which I themed around Harry Potter, started at that school by that point, and so I needed to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get back on the Monday morning to get back to Manchester to go to work after Cursed Child. So I didn't really have a lot of time to process it afterwards. But
and I saw my perfect mother. I got up with you, Elspeth. Make sure you were awake at the right stop to get you off the train.
I mean, but, you know, like I would have done it. Probably anyway. But no, I think like all of us, we, you know, as soon as the book came out, we all like ran out and got a copy and read it in 2 hours. And no, that's not the right way to experience a 8 hour long play. So I think it's just it the two experiences don't really compare whatsoever. You know, I do think like any piece of theatre, you do have to see it in order to fully appreciate it.
And so even though you were disappointed with the reading, you still thought it's still worth seeing.
Oh yeah, definitely worth seeing to see it in its full context as how it was meant to be done, and how it was meant to be enjoyed. I'd say, like, obviously if you can't do that, then, you know, that's a shame. But if you have to be sorry for yourself
if you can't see it.
You are perfectly legitimate to feel hard done by and oppressed by the capitalist system with which we all live under.
Well, I think
if
about
you can see it, then I would definitely go and see Cursed Child.
You know, I think this, it's so technologically complex. I think, like, will I even get to see like a high school version of it or something, you know, just to be able to see it? But it seems so complex. Maybe it can only be produced by a professional company. I don't know.
Yeah, all those high schools that can put a $33 million investment into the
my goodness. Yeah.
No, I think that eventually there's going to be ways that they create items that people can use in smaller theater situations to be able to do it in those kinds of contexts. Because I really do think that the magic, the onstage magic, is incredibly important. But there's enough witches and wizards around the world that they should be able to put some of those elements on stage, if not the whole thing. But if we see it in the next 10 years, I will be shocked.
There we go. Yeah, a $35 million rebuild of the lyric. Just saying. I mean, that's...
Sorry, I've also got to say, like, you know, as a primary school teacher, I do see a lot of West End and Broadway plays that are adapted for primary school children, one being The Lion King, which I've had my eye on for a while now. You know, it's now my professional goal to have The Lion King performed by 11-year-olds.
Awesome.
So you can adapt these plays and make them accessible to children and make them accessible to smaller audiences and dispersed audiences around.
Well, Elspeth and Heidi, you're giving me hope, so I'm just going to cling to that hope there. Yeah, and so how about you, Tracy and Heidi? How did you guys score tickets to the play?
I never win anything. And I entered an online lottery every Friday to get tickets, and I happened to score two for seeing it in previews at the Lyric. I couldn't believe it. I still sort of can't believe it.
Awesome. Winner of the lottery.
Hey, wow.
It does happen. Dope. Keep the dream alive.
I did not win the lottery, but one of my colleagues did.
Oh,
and
cool.
He had primarily entered it for me. And I wanted to do was get tickets to preview week, because I was supposed to be in the Northeast, because it coincided with my kid's spring break. And all I wanted was preview week. And of course, the first time the tickets went on sale back in the fall, they screwed up their coding system. And you couldn't actually buy tickets for preview week if you went on, like, whatever Chrome browser it was that I was using, it didn't work.
Oh.
So you could only buy tickets if you bought tickets in the disabled row, and I wasn't willing to do that. So I ended up getting tickets for July, and I'm going again in July with some of my girlfriends from fandom, and I can't wait. But I still wanted to get tickets to go in the spring. And when the second batch of tickets, I guess the returned ones and the ones they discovered were from scalpers, et cetera, when those went on sale, there were so many tickets still available for the previews, because I think that they know that something got screwed up, and I think that they stopped those ticket sales during the ticket sale process. So I managed to get tickets to go and see it the first time that it was a 2-day performance. And then, of course, there was a blizzard in New York the day of the second performance.
Oh,
and
no.
We were waiting to find out if it was going to get canceled. And like 11:30 in the morning, they were like, no shows on Broadway, will be dark tonight. And we were like, oh, thankfully.
Awesome.
Oh, yes. So I got to take my 14-year-old, and it was awesome.
Oh, wonderful.
Aww.
That's great.
Oh, that's lovely.
So did you each went with other people who are also Harry Potter fans then?
It's an interesting kind of perspective, because my partner is a playwright and has never read any of the books or seen any of the movies, except he read Cursed Child with me when it came out. And he loved it. I had opinions, you know, I had feelings after reading the script. But he thought it was spectacular. And so we went together, and it was really interesting to get his perspective as someone, in theater. And he thought it was wildly successful as a play.
Well, cool. That's great. What a good perspective to have. You can even share with us the outsider perspective. Although we're mostly interested in the insider perspective, I guess. It's our main audience here. So let's just start with overall impressions. I got the feeling that most of you did not really love reading the play, but did you like seeing it? Did it give you a full Harry Potter experience? Let's start with Heidi on this one.
I actually didn't dislike reading it.
Oh, good.
But I think that for me, that's a matter of context. I've been reading fanfic on electronic devices since 2000.
Wow.
So,
same.
So for me, when I got Cursed a Child, I got the Kindle version. So here I am sitting in bed, reading it on my iPad, the same way that I've been reading, fanfic for years and years. So for me, it just felt natural to be reading another Harry Potter story. Yes, one that had, fic prompts by J.K. Rowling herself, but in a lot of ways, I was just reading another Harry Potter story on my digital device the way that I always do. And I raced to the end of it because I had, you know, it was marked complete. So I felt like I could, you know, read the whole thing. But for me, I had had so many friends who'd seen it on stage by that point, and I really just wanted to catch up. We had just had our Harry Potter panel at San Diego Comic-Con where people were sort of talking about it, and a couple people brought me Keep the Secrets pins, but I still had no idea anything that had happened. So for me, it was just, I enjoyed the reading experience, and I enjoyed sort of squeeing on Twitter about little bits, and I just had a fun time reading a story that I liked. And you know, I want to keep the secrets and I don't want to give away any of the specific lines. But when I hit a certain line that, say, was vaguely reminiscent of Starkid Potter, I was like, oh my God!
You're bringing that, the fan experience, into your experience of reading it, but also seeing it, huh?
Yes, it was layers of joy and fun.
That's wonderful. Well, how about, let's see, Dolores and Elspeth, you did not totally care for the play, but you saw it anyway. And did you like the play overall when you saw it?
Yes, I did like the play, but I'd have liked it a lot better if it hadn't been Harry Potter characters, because I really didn't like what they did with some of the characters.
Oh.
I mean, am I allowed to sort of instance actual events in the play?
Please.
Yeah.
Please.
Well, I mean, in what universe is Cedric Diggory ever going to be a Death Eater? He just never would be. Ever. You know? He is the golden boy. He's self-sacrificial. He's wonderful. You know?
Yeah.
And very good looking too, of course, but that's by the way. But he never would be a Death Eater. And why is Harry such a lousy dad all of a sudden?
Yeah,
he's fine with the others. You know? And why is Dumbledore still breaking his heart about how he, in inverted commas, didn't bring up Harry? You know, they've sorted that out. The story, with all the time travel and all this sort of thing, I thought was great. I love time travel stories. But to my mind, these were not Harry Potter characters. But hey, that's just my opinion.
Hmm. Elspeth, what did you think? You were there with your mother there.
Well, I mean, I've got to say, I agree with Heidi, because it really was like, you know, just reading another fanfic that everybody else is talking about. You know, it's like, you know, you get the ones that like spike up on your Tumblr blog or whatever. But for me, before I went to go and see it, I actually set it as a text for my book club, which is where a bunch of 10-year-olds came together and we ate biscuits and drank Vimto and things, and we read out the play, and just in that moment, just hearing these quite stilted voices reading out these characters, it did lift it to the point where you could actually see them of the piece, so you weren't just going through and going, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened. You're actually like hearing the story and the narrative through the characters. It's these accusations of like it's fanfic, and I think it is because you know, you see so many, like, you know, so many tropes, like, you know, Cedric is evil and Voldemort's daughter, and they're like, these are like fanfic cliches which anybody with that kind of diet is very well aware of. So seeing them like this, it's not very shocking, but eye-raising, like, oh, you went down this route, okay, interesting, tight Turner story, oh, we haven't seen those before, I guess.
So you think that, like Heidi, like you were sort of prepped, primed to like it through your reading of fan fiction?
I very rarely like finished any of those like epic magnum opuses that people wrote like in the mid-2000s and everything. I was like, wow, the amount of time they spent on them, it was insane. But the through line of it just sort of got lost in the chapter 88 of everyone hangs out at the library again, you know. So I mean, but to actually like see those tropes and everything, or recognize those tropes in this $33 million production was quite surprising. But I think the actual play itself is it does like bring the magic to it just in the stagecraft. And I, although some of the characters that do act problematically as far as their like character arcs have been developed and set up in the books themselves, I do think that there's still a lot going for Cursed Child that you, yeah, like I said, you just don't get just reading it flat on the screen, on the page.
And now, Tracy, I know that you actually framed a defense of the Cursed Child before you had even seen it. So when you saw it, did that affect your understanding of the play?
Well, I've got to say, I must be just very susceptible to emotionally charged communal theatrical experiences. I psychotically loved it. I loved it more than I expected to. I bought everything I could afford that was associated with it, which, you know, pretty much defines a Harry Potter experience for me. My defense was largely structural, like, why does this have to be a play? And my issues were largely content-based, and there was something about seeing it. It's not like I didn't have those issues anymore, but they were pushed so far back in my head, and it was just all heart for me watching it and being there.
So kind of an emotional experience. That's what I'm hearing. Absolutely. Is that you like it as an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's talk specifics. What were the best parts of the performance? What did you like the best? Let's start this one with Heidi. Tell us.
Oh, God. I love the boys. I thought that Scorpius and Albus were just fantastic. They were great characters. The actors were amazing. And the way that they sort of brought this new generation to life for me was just absolutely fantastic. And it was just captivating from the very, very start of the play. I loved seeing Harry in sort of this more grown-up context, and parenting is just awful sometimes. And, you know, it's seeing him in that sort of context, I thought, was fantastic. I loved the AU characters. I can tell we're talking some spoilers, so I'm going to go for it. I loved the interaction in the alternate universes, the alternate timelines. Mm-hmm. So where the story differs from the original narrative. And obviously, in this, you know, all of that is past book 7, or I think almost all of it was past book 7, in terms of the alternate universes. But sort of getting to see how those interactions took place was fantastic. I loved Ron. I mean, I got a lot of grief back in like 2000, 2001, 2002 for not being a Ron fan. I didn't think that he was mature enough. I didn't love his character at that point. I'm not 100% sure we're supposed to, especially with some of his interactions in Goblet of Fire with Harry. And seeing him in this context, I was like, that he's adorable and wonderful and awesome. And I was just enchanted. And as a Draco fangirl from long back, who has been, you know, I'm one of the people who J.K. Rowling was probably talking about when she talked about redemption arcs and not liking them. And he was perfect. He was absolutely perfect.
Cool.
Yeah. So I liked almost everything.
One of the things that I always thought was a little problematic about the series was that Draco didn't have a redemptive moment, really. I had sort of thought he would have an opportunity to show that, and he didn't. And this play does give not only him that opportunity, but his son. I've heard that Scorpius is just such a really lovable character.
Hang on, can I just disagree for a minute?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, please. About Draco having a redemptive moment. Surely he has one in the Deathly Hallows.
When Harry,
Ron, and Hermione turn up at Malfoy Manor, and Draco knows absolutely who they are. Harry might have been hit by stinging jinx, but the other two haven't. He knows who they are, but he's not giving them away.
I guess. Yeah, I think that's kind of weak myself, but I see what you're saying.
It's not in the same sort of like redemptive arc as like, let me fall on the sword for you. It's let me fudge the truth for you.
I don't know if you got Beatrice Lestrange breathing down your neck.
Oh no, I mean it was brave of him in that moment, but it also I felt like that matched the character to not be suddenly super heroic, and still like kind of looking out for himself, and you know, like seeing that this thing is wrong, but not actually standing up for somebody, but for just not telling someone else the truth. That works for Draco in that, and I think that carries on into The Cursed Child.
That he's still kind of operating in a similar manner.
Yeah, he's still self-serving, and he's still I was never a Draco fangirl, I'm sorry. I was Harry all the way. Yeah. Like from day one, I was like, Harry spoke to me so much. I loved him from the very beginning. I think they did Draco really well.
Draco was excellent. I mean, when you said about the two boys, I couldn't agree more. The two boys are outstanding, I think. They're really good in the play.
Well, I think one of the things that it maybe gives you a chance to wonder, because, you know, Draco initially extends his hand to Harry and says, let's be friends. And then the next generation, we see Harry's son and Draco's son actually forging a friendship. And so it gives you a chance to see what that might look like. It's kind of fun.
And also because Scorpius is such the anti-Malfoy, he's fascinating, and he's so sweet, and he's such a nerd, and you can't help but fall head over heels in love with him. When we went to go and see it, we didn't see Anthony Boyle, who originated the role in London. Theo Ancient, remarkable, and he was the best part of it because he was so lively and.
I'm going to jump in here because these actors must be spectacular, because Scorpius has the worst lines in the play. I mean, he says things like, oh my, that's her, wow, squeak, my geekiness is a quivering.
He sells it, he is fantastic.
Wow, this kid is going to get so many Tonys and Emmys. This is great. And Gorgium impressed. You know, I mean, this kid is just burdened with the worst possible lines. Anyway, go on. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, the thing is, he's going to be up against some awesome people for the Tonys. I don't know if he's going to be seen as a contender, but he should be.
Okay.
All right. So Tracy, what do you think in terms of some of your favorite aspects of the performance?
I think I'm going to talk, I guess, maybe one high-tech thing and one low-tech thing. Previous listeners of this podcast might remember that I kind of have a soft spot for Dementors, and the way they are imagined was literally breathtaking for me. They were incredible. And in terms of a low-tech thing, I thought the incorporation of dance in the production I saw was really, really powerful to set a mood, to make it a different experience than a movie, but a really just resonant one for me. I love those parts.
So there's dance in it.
Yes.
Where's the dance? Yeah. Did I miss that in the script? Where's the dancing?
I don't think it's in the script. I mean, it's dancey the way they change the sets, which has to happen so quickly. I mean, I'm sure you remember from reading it, these scenes go by quickly, and they're radically different places.
There's 70. This is John the Structuralist interrupting here. There's 75 scene changes.
Oh my gosh!
And they're quick. You know, it could be a page and a half, and you go from Hogwarts to the Ministry of Magic, but they pull it off with these fabulous clothes.
It's wonderful because these scene changes happen in the blink of an eye, you know, and very often a piece of set is turned around and there you are somewhere else. It's the stagecraft is absolutely remarkable, I think. It's just the story I've got problems.
They kind of make the transition, I felt, from, you know, the AU, new term for me, but very useful one. The AU where... well, I don't want to spoil too much, but where now it's really bad. They set that tone with sort of a dance that's a little bit resonant of, in the film Goblet of Fire, the Durmstrang students entering the Great Hall.
Oh.
But somehow even more chilling and terrifying, the way that sort of mood is set.
Yeah.
Because that was the beginning of the second act of part two.
Yes.
So suddenly, and you go out of the theater and then you go back in, and all of the shop is changed, and all of the decor in the theater is changed, and the lighting is changed, and then you get this intense dance sequence going in, and you're like, woohoo! You know, it's like you're ready to be chilled.
Yes.
So let me ask you all about this, because it's so interesting to have it performed in two separate performances. So it's two separate days, and what's your experience of seeing it the one day and then having to wait to watch the rest of it?
Well, I saw it in one day.
Actually. Okay, you saw it in one day.
I saw a 2 p.m. and then an 8 p.m., and I loved that. I mean, it felt very much like you were completely immersing yourself in this world, and it did not – I wasn't tired at all. I mean, the thought of it was a little daunting, but in experience, it was energizing rather than exhausting to me.
Yeah, ours was a one-day performance as well.
Okay.
Yeah, which I preferred rather than having to spread it out over 2 days, because you know, you can get caught up in it. With all my reservations, you can get caught up in it.
Am I the only one who did see it on both days separated?
I think that's right, Heidi.
Yeah. Okay, so I can ramble a little bit and give restaurant sure. recommendations for those going in.
Perfect.
Okay, so I actually liked seeing it in the evening and then getting to go home and sort of ponder it and sleep on it and get to spend, you know, the next day. We were also dealing with a blizzard, so we were sort of staying home and being cozy and looking over the first section of the book again and just going back to little bits we liked and refusing to read ahead. I had not, by the way, reopened the book since I got my tickets last fall. Uh-huh. So I hadn't looked it over again for probably 7-8 months. And then sort of going for a nice walk the next day, and yes, in the snow, and having dinner. And I had a matcha cocktail across the street at Haru that was vaguely green, that I highly recommend for those who like cocktails with a little bit of kick.
There's a very good pub across the across from the theatre in London too.
Awesome. Good business.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So let me ask you all what you liked the least about the performance, the things that you didn't really care for. And I'm gonna start with Dolores, because Dolores, I know there were things that you didn't like, especially in terms of the story. There were things about the performance that just didn't resonate with you, things that you liked the least about it.
Things I liked the least about it. I didn't like Ginny. She didn't seem to do anything but come on and shout. There was Ginny in the books. I don't think she's very successful in the films either, but Ginny in the books has got such spark. You know, she doesn't have much to do, but she's such an energetic character. And she was just bad-tempered, I thought, in Cursed Child. And also, I didn't care for Hermione either, because I didn't think she was Hermione. She never looked at a book. She never said, "I'm off to the library." I mean, she was with a bookcase, but she never picked one up. And it was just not Hermione being Hermione, really.
Oh, all right.
The only instance of Hermione's bookcase you see is that her bookcase has been weaponized. You get the sense that Hermione doesn't actually use it anymore, apart from to hide a secret, when the whole point of Hermione and book is that the books have the secret in them, and it's open knowledge to everyone, but Hermione is the only one who seems to access it. So it did sort of miss the point. Yeah, unfortunately, Ginny does seem to be the weak link. Came on and delivered her lines like a West End actor, and very highly enunciated, and there wasn't really much of a performance to it. I mean, I had the same experience when I went to go and see Les Mis, and Fontaine came on, and she sang A Dream Dream, but like so overpronounced, I was like half willing to just go, stop, everybody, no, we're going to start again, find a new Fontaine. This
try
isn't right. But no, I think out of the performances, Ginny's was the weak link. But I think, you know, it's just that the way that some of the characters were portrayed in the story, which doesn't seem to have much to do with Voldemort's character as we know him at all. That does just leave like a sticking point where you're just like, oh, come on, guys.
So kind of the Voldemort part of the play, you didn't totally
Voldemort
buy that.
Um, No, and I heard this on Witch Please, actually, another podcast for Harry Potter, and they said it much better than I ever would. Is that Voldemort and his idea of legacy is that he is his legacy. He doesn't need children because he is immortal. So the idea that Voldemort would have a child just flies in the face of that character. He wouldn't be thinking about the next generation because he is the next generation.
Yeah, I thought that instantly when I read it, you know, because I kept on, when I was reading the play for the first time, I kept on thinking, come on, you know, we're going to have the big revelation that Delphi thinks that she's Voldemort's daughter and she's going to have a shattering disappointment. That's going to be a big reveal that this is all in her mind, the idea about being Voldemort's daughter. And then I was really disappointed when it turned out she was Voldemort's daughter. For a start, I couldn't see when that would have happened. Damn quick work. You know, why does Voldemort want children? Of course he doesn't. As Elspeth said, he is himself. You know, he doesn't need to pass anything on to anybody. And he certainly doesn't want to dandle little ones on his knee, you know. He's not that sort of person. So I think it would have been stronger if Delphi had grown up with this sort of Death Eater-ish fascination with Voldemort, which then got overturned. But hey, I'm not writing the play.
So what about you, Heidi? Did you buy the Voldemort part of it?
I do, but okay, without getting too far into, you know, the weeds of fan theories, I don't necessarily believe that this was something that Voldemort himself planned, intended, or chose, and it may have been Bellatrix's idea.
And the story, you think, kind of leaves that open as a possibility as it's performed?
Yes, I don't think that we have any confirmation at all that this is something that he was aware of or had an active role in creating.
But Voldemort is all about control, and Bellatrix, from what we know from the books, like, she is completely subservient to him. So the idea that she would, you know, go off and have a kid without his knowledge doesn't really...
With the intention of presenting him with, you know, this extra awesome magical thing, you know, afterwards. Who knows? Because she, you know, was kind of crazy anyway. But...
He's the extra awesome magical thing. So why would she go, look, here is a competitor?
These just seem like questions that the, you know, the storyline raises, but it doesn't, maybe it doesn't totally address them. It doesn't resolve them.
No,
which is sort of what I love about this. I mean, I certainly have some of the same issues with content that have been shared already. But I love that it gets us a way to talk about these characters in a different way, to interpret them, to imagine them, to kind of speculate on their motivations. I think it's so cool that the play's conceit of retelling and or resisting the accounts that we get in the book is a really good opportunity to kind of get even more deeply into what we know of this world. Like, it really deepened the world for me seeing this play and reading it too.
Well, so this leads me to another question to ask all of you all, and we'll start with Tracy on this one. So do you think the play allows you to think about the original Harry Potter story in new ways that are productive, that are helping you to rethink characters or rethink the possibilities? You know, my theory on why J.K. Rowling puts her stamp of approval on this project is that it kind of satisfies her writerly urge to rethink aspects of the book and to go back into it. And I wonder if you all, in seeing it, felt as though it gave you the opportunity to go back into it and really think about it, maybe from a different perspective.
For me, it absolutely did. The talk you referenced earlier, I did sort of the defense of The Cursed Child that I wrote before I had seen it. My way into thinking about The Cursed Child as theater in particular was really aided by this book, The Haunted Stage, Theater as Memory Machine by Marvin Carlson. And my guiding question was sort of like, why is there no theater in the Wizarding World? Like, we have these other sorts of art forms like music and, of course, visual art and radio and books, but they don't put on plays. And Carlson says that drama more than any other literary form suits itself to recirculating cultural memory, telling important stories in different ways. And because of magical access to the past, you know, portraits that talk to you, paint in memory, or ghosts that explain things to you, or a pensive, you could just go and look. It seems that maybe you don't need a way of retelling cultural stories. But then I think the play pushes back against that and says, well, it's still possible to look at these stories, which if you're a fan, you know so well, and present a different account, maybe even a dissenting account. You know, maybe Harry wasn't the selfless hero that we all thought he was. Maybe Cedric didn't have to die. And seeing the play and seeing these characters reenact moments from the book and the other books, I thought was really productive for me in terms of thinking about the possibilities that Rowling's texts give us to think outside of those very same texts, if that makes any sense at all.
Sure. Yeah, well, let's see. Heidi, what do you think about that? Did it make you think about the books in a different way?
To some extent, yes, but I've been thinking about the books, you know, from, like, in what other direction could this have happened? What's the backstory for this? You know, going back now 18 years. So for me...
It's not new.
For me, it's not new, and it's not a new feeling. You know, the one thing that, you know, the one thing that I always want in my Harry Potter stories at this point is I want more Regulus, and I'm never going to get it, and I'm never going to get the full backstory, and I'm never going to get the narrative I want out of that. And so for me, more backstory or an additional perspective or how another person views, you know, what happened in the past and what could happen in the future is just more fun and enjoyment. And I'm, you know, I'm not analyzing it for, I've given up on trying to predict what's going to happen next. I did enough of that in 2000, 2001, 2002, and I never want to go back there. So for me, at this point, there's no wrong theorizing. There's no wrong way to predict something or to enjoy something. And that's, you know, that's really just the point where I'm at with this. And I, you know, I got enjoyment from being able to see it and to be able to, you know, talk to the little kids who were sitting next to me and, you know, the 30-something couple at the end of my row and, you know, hear what they thought was going to happen next and how it was translated to the stage. And that, I think, is really just the joy of being able to do this. You know, John was talking earlier about the fan cons that I used to organize. Uh-huh. And still, you know, I still do the Harry Potter panel at Comic-Con. Hopefully they'll accept it for this summer. Waiting to find out. And we get, you know, over 1,000 people in the room to talk about Harry Potter. Wow. For an hour every summer. And it's a consistency that I love because we're always coming back to how we enjoy the story and what personal bits, you know, we want to highlight and talk about and think about. And that's, you know, that's just really what I was there for and what I got out of it was just another enjoyable and fantastic way to experience everything fantastically Harry Potter.
You know, I was thinking about this, too, as I was, you know, thinking about this episode that we're doing here. And you, when you read the books, it's such a solitary experience, but you love it so much you want to share it with somebody. I was thinking about this, getting my kids to read the books so I can talk to them about it. Where are you? What's going on? You know? And the play maybe gives us an opportunity to really share this experience with others in a community setting, you know, that even though it's flawed, it actually gives us an opportunity to exist in that world with other people and to look around at the people, you know, in the seats next to you. And yeah, we're here. We're in the Harry Potter world. So it sort of sounds like that's kind of what you're thinking about too.
Definitely.
Well, Elspeth, what do you think? Did seeing the play allow you to think about the Harry Potter book series in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, just going back to what Tracy was saying about paint and memories, it just reminded me of, like, the way that that scene with Dumbledore and Harry, and Harry just, like, lays out Dumbledore and just basically screams at him that he left him as a lonely child. And all Dumbledore can say that, you know, it's just paint and memories. And that, for me, it recast Harry as somebody who was profoundly lonely. when he was growing up, when he was a child. You know, this is somebody to whom we're introduced as Bud. And, you know, at first, like, when I was reading it when I was eight when I first read it, it was a fairy tale, it was a fantasy. But looking back, you know, he did not have a happy childhood at all. And from then on, he learnt to live by himself and do everything his own way. And for me, like, just that conversation, going back to the books, you begin to understand why Harry is so pig-headed and wants to do everything by himself and won't include his friends and won't include this support network that he's got and always is thinking about himself, is because he was conditioned to do that from growing up with the Dursleys. And, you know, when you just, like, as an adult, he can say the damage that that has caused. And it was heartbreaking to actually see, and to actually see how, you know, my favourite character, like, actually really suffered. And how that had manifested itself throughout the series itself.
So, Dolores, I know you and I had chatted just briefly, and you had said something about the way Snape is in one of the alternative universes. Did that make you think about Snape in a different way?
Not a different way, no, because it completely confirmed what I thought about Snape.
Okay.
Oh, no, I really, really like Snape in the play. That is a massive plus for the play. I think he comes over exceptionally well. And I forget the name of the actor playing him, but he was knockout. They're really good. I mean, by and large, the cast is absolutely terrific, with a couple of exceptions.
You thought that was consistent with the Snape of the stories? Let's see.
It's consistent with the Snape that we all know is there, that underneath. Mm. You know, he's not actually. I mean, one of my daughters, Helen, came out with this wonderful phrase that to sum up Snape was that he's a character who has a redeeming flaw. A redeeming virtue, rather. You know how in Shakespeare characters have a fatal flaw, you know, a fatal virtue, his love for Lily. But he's not a nice person. However, he's allowed to be a lot nicer in the play while still being Snape. I thought it was great. And can I just talk about one scene that I really did like?
Absolutely.
And thought was terrific? And that's the very end, where they've all got to watch Voldemort murder Lily and James again. Uh-huh. That is absolutely crackling. It's a super scene. And, I was absolutely on the edge of my seat waiting for that. And it reminded me very much of the big finale to Kill a Mockingbird. You know, when they go to Beau Ridley's house. It was, that same tension and everything. Oh, it was that was a superb scene. And anybody who's not seen it, you know, the best is at the end, I think. You know, you'll enjoy it. I honestly think it's a very enjoyable play. It's just that I have such problems with the story. But, that's just me being totally word-bound, I think.
So that last scene, I guess, is supposed to really confront you with the necessity of this terrible thing happening in the past.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's got all the emotional ingredients that it needs to really make you reckon with that.
It sort of ties in with the theme previously. It's like, the whole mess starts when somebody suggests that, you know, Cedric Diggory didn't have to die. And it's this idea that, you know, you could have had Harry Potter without bad things happening, where, you know, you definitely absolutely can't. You know, there has to be some degree of suffering and some degree of pain and growth from it in order for the good things to happen. And, you know, you try to change that, then even worse things will happen. I mean, not saying that it's inevitable that these things do happen, that it was inevitable for Cedric Diggory to die, but for the play to make its entire cast stop and just look and be powerless to do anything was really, in itself, really powerful.
Well, and one of the other things that I found fascinating about that final scene, it's not the final scene in the play, but that pivotal scene, that denouement, is that it's going to change. Like, even though we don't really see Harry after that point in any, you know, extensive context, we know as the audience that Harry experiencing this surrounded by all the people that he loves is going to change how he thinks about Godric's Hollow and how he thinks about his parents' death, because yeah. he's always going to know Carrie into his entire future that he wasn't alone, that they weren't alone when this happened, that there were witnesses who know and who will remember forever what happened there, even if there mm-hmm. wasn't anything that they could do about it. And I think that from a psychology of Harry Potter perspective, that is not going to be anything but good for him as, you know, a person growing and having experienced this, you know, with one of his children, is going to change how their relationship is forever in, I think, some very positive ways. So when do we get part 9?
As soon as they film Cursed Child, Heidi, I think
no, it won't
they'll go into production on 9.
Oh, you don't it think they work. Could make a film of it?
They can, but it would require literally a virtual reality experience. If they want to wait, you know, 8-9 years and then do it with virtual reality, I know some people who would definitely love to do this in that kind of a situation, but I think it needs that kind of immersive experience.
Hey, virtual reality. Now, that's something I'd really enjoy. Yeah.
What were the crowd reactions to the play? What, you know, how did the audiences seem to like it? Were there people who were kind of, you know, talking about, well, they're not doing this the right way, or this wouldn't have happened, or are people just super excited? I believe you said you psychotically loved it, Tracy. What was the crowd reaction there?
In my experience, the performance I saw, everyone was totally into it. There were multiple people in costume, including yours truly. And what I thought was really cool in contrast to other Broadway shows I've seen in which there's like a big name in the cast, you know, like Al Pacino comes out and people applaud, you know, they applaud Al Pacino. But in Cursed Child, people would applaud a character. Like when Neville got mentioned, people were like applauding. When people saw Snape for the first time, they were applauding. And that's something that my partner, who I mentioned, who was leaning over, was like, is that Dumbledore? Like, he didn't get to experience that part of it. But he also remarked on how cool it was to watch something with an audience that were so invested in these characters versus just being excited to see a famous actor in person. It was like seeing the characters in person. I was really taken with it.
The audience in London were absolutely ecstatic. Got a standing ovation, and they weren't applauding characters they mentioned, but you could have heard a pin drop. You know, the attention was absolutely total, and that's quite an experience actually, to be in a crowded theatre where everybody is totally concentrating. It's obviously full of Harry Potter fans, but the audience really loved it. And the friend I was with, I'm glad to say, she'd spent so long on the internet trying to get these blessed tickets. She absolutely loved it.
I mean, some of it has to be that you work so hard to get the tickets, you're ready to have a great experience, right?
Yeah. Oh, she absolutely loved it. And I'll say I kept my opinions to myself, really, because I really did have huge reservations. I'd heard so often that seeing it was very different from reading it. But in fact, all the criticisms I'd had when reading it didn't go away when I actually saw it. I thought it was very, very, very well done, and I'm glad I've seen it. But I still think it's fan fiction, really.
So Heidi, you were talking about there being some kids sitting next to you, and what were the experiences of the crowd that you were in.
So on one side of me was a family of, I think, four, two parents, two younger kids. I don't think they could have been older than 11. And on the other side of me was my son. And then on the other side of him was a couple who were in their 30s. And I spent a little time before the second performance talking with the family and basically saying, you know, asking the kids, what have you seen? Have you read all the books? And, you know, fair disclosure, my 14-year-old has not read all of the books. He hasn't seen all the films. He believes that he was completely spoiled by me and his older brother, and he is not interested in seeing movies 7 and 7B. He's read some of it, and he's read Curse of Child. So the kids were sort of talking about, you know, the first couple books and Cedric and Goblet of Fire and, you know, how they don't really like Snape and things like that, because none of them had read book 7, which I thought was just a very interesting perspective to bring to this. They all sort of know the story. They know the big spoilers, but they don't necessarily know, you know, the nuances and the elements of the story. And then the couple who was on the other side of me were both, you know, they had read the books growing up and in college, and one of them had, you know, done a little bit of Quidditch, and they were just there, you know, as fans of the series and the world and the stories. And they, you know, I started the round of applause for Neville, and they picked it up like within half a beat, because it was just, there's one line and I don't want to repeat it. It's so great. And it's that's really the fun aspect of it, is just that communal experience of everybody enjoying it together. Because I saw it at a preview, I don't know if any of the rest of you did, but because I'd seen it in the first, basically, I think it was like the second time that they were going through both parts in front of an audience, there actually was a stage glitch, like a piece of the set did not move properly. And they put the curtain down and they started that scene. They didn't start it over, but they took it back a few lines. And everyone in the audience was just, okay, this is the second performance. We know this happens. And it literally took them 15 seconds for everybody to just be completely captivated back in the story. But, you know, we had like a 5 or 6 minute stop where they had to fix the set, and that happens.
Apparently, I was talking to a chap who'd seen the previews in London, and they'd tried to use real owls on stage.
They
all flew off and sat in the balcony, and they had to have the owl trainer come in and bring them all down again.
Oh my gosh.
I love live theater.
Okay, so now we're going to get to our big question. It's been lingering over our whole conversation, which is the question about, you know, whether we should regard this as a piece of the Harry Potter canon. You know, the play is by Jack Thorne, but it is based on an original story by J.K. Rowling, John Tiffany, and Jack Thorne, and Rowling has maintained that this is a canonical part of the Harry Potter story. So when you see that, when you saw the play, you know, did that affect the way that you see it? Do you think that this is a part of canon? I know I'm going to start with Tiffany Start with Heidi, because I know, Heidi, you've said that you don't think this is fan fiction. Does that mean you do think that it's canon?
Yes, I do think it's canon. I think that any story written by J.K. Rowling is canon. However, I think this play definitely shows that she is comfortable writing AUs, again, alternate universes. And I think the way that she wove all of those concepts together, I think definitely brings it, you know, within the hallmark of what something is that is or is not canonical. I mean, we know with regard to Fantastic Beasts, yes, she wrote the screenplay, but that doesn't necessarily mean that every single word that she wrote made it onto the screen, and it doesn't necessarily mean that every single word she wrote was translated to the screen the way that it would have been had it been, you know, in a novel form. And, you know, even if we go back to the first Harry Potter book, is the US version of it canon because it has some slightly different language, or is the UK version the one that's canon? So, you know, for me, anything where she wrote the story is canon. And I don't get personally. I just don't get caught up in, you know, individual word usage, because I can't. My first experience reading the Harry Potter books was the U.S. version of Philosopher's Stone, which of course was called Sorcerer's Stone all the way through, but I read Chamber of Secrets in the UK version. So I didn't have a consistent, you know, nationality reading experience of it. And I just can't feel like the individual word choices are necessarily 100% J.K. Rowling, because she had editors, she had, you know, things got changed. The entire wand order in the original version of book four was messed up completely through printing, I think, 13. So I look to the story as being something that's canon.
You feel like J.K. Rowling's mark is on this story?
Yes, and there wasn't any plot element or character element that happened on stage that she didn't approve of.
So, and I think I can sort of see why J.K. Rowling would, you know, would put her stamp of approval on this. As I said, I think it does allow her to revisit the story and revisit maybe some controversial authorial choices that she made. You know, did Cedric Diggory have to die? And you can tell she's still thinking about those things because of the apologies that she sends out every now and again. And, you know, historians, we do counterfactual history sometimes, the what-if history, like, what are the causes that had to be there? What are the variables that had to be there in order for a particular event to happen? And it strikes me that this is a kind of exercise in counterfactual thinking. Those are the alternate universes. And this gives her a chance to say, yes, it did have to happen the way that I wrote it. It confirms her world in some ways. And I can see her, you know, signing off on it, even if it may not be perfectly in keeping with her voice. I'm striking at it.
That's such an interesting way of looking at it. And I've never thought of it like that before. And I think you're dead right.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Dolores, we need to have you on more often.
this idea, though, of something being
canonical. I agree with
you too, Katie. Yes, Elspeth, tell us.
This idea of something being canonical or not, it kind of reminds me of the backlash that Last Jedi got, you know, Star Wars. And it was, I mean, because I think objectively, The Last Jedi is a brilliantly crafted film, and it takes the characters into interesting places, and it's novel and daring, and people really didn't like it. And I remember seeing one petition out of many silly petitions. It's like, have The Last Jedi struck from canon?
Oh my!
And it's just like, yeah, I know. God, people have had such the wrong opinion about this film. But this idea of, like, is something canonical or not? I mean, does it matter? Yeah, it's a new Harry Potter story, and I think it isn't fan fiction because it's making money, and that's the classical sense of fan fiction, that, you know, you don't make money from it. But it's like it's being viewed as something outside of itself. Like The Cursed Child and The Last Jedi are being seen as like a pop culture moment rather than an excellent piece of theatre or as an excellent film. And I think because, you know, people have been waiting you know, since 2007 for the next Harry Potter story, and they've got their own ideas of how it should go and how these characters should act and what Harry should do and how Draco should be. And then it comes out and somebody tells them that no, it's like this. And I can perfectly understand why people were irritated to be told that their fan theories were incorrect. I mean, that sounded really like pompous and dismissive. I didn't mean it like that. But it's just like being frustrated that the world isn't being seen as you have seen it yourself in the future. And like, I think the same happened with Last Jedi, and I think we're seeing this with Cursed Child as well.
I think the comparison with The Force Awakens is really instructive, because you had the same sort of backlash also in terms of diversity and casting that you got
totally, like a black stormtrooper. It's like, oh my god. Way. No way, you racist. Yeah.
I mean, I've always been sort of loosey-goosey when it comes to defining canon anyway, so I'm fine with thinking of it in that way, though Yeah, I think Janet Malcolm said something like, when you give something a label, all you're doing is describing a problem. And I think that's sort of true, like the problem of how to treat Cursed Child, not only because the text itself is so nebulous, you know, it's a story by and a script by, and also, does each performance count as a text? I would kind of argue it does. And then this multiplicity that starts to surround the story, I think, becomes difficult for scholars to get a handle on, but I think also kind of a cool new way to think through a fan universe.
Yeah, and if you really didn't like Cursed Child, then nobody is forcing you to read it or watch it or anything. And also because, like, and again, really pompous. I'm sorry. No, I need a tweed jacket and a copy of the Daily Mail. But no, I mean, all I mean to say is that there is so much fan creation going on now that your own version of it, yeah, you know, might be better than it. You don't have to accept this as the one thing, and this is why, like, analysis is great, and, you know, critical feedback is great. What Lin-Manuel Miranda did with the story of Hamilton, you know, like, completely upended the idea of who the founding fathers were.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's as close to fan fiction as I think, you know, you can get on the stage.
That's neat. Hamilton is fan fiction for history. I love that.
Oh, it is. I mean, people have been talking about it as real person fiction, obviously, you know, since it opened. But I think that that's one of the amazing things about the stage. And I say this because when I was up in New York in March, not only did we see Harry Potter, we saw Mean Girls, which Tina Fey wrote herself, reinterpreting the original movie. Same characters, you know, same overall story. But without being too spoilery about it, it's been updated to 2018. And she had even, I saw it, I think maybe the like second week that it was in previews, and there were some lines in it that had been updated in the last week. It was very, very obvious because I saw it the day before the march for safer schools in you know, around the country, and there was a line in it that was very relevant to, you know, the fact that was that weekend even. So that's, you know, another person who's reinterpreting her original canon from the early 2000s, you know, with some different perspectives and with a modern viewpoint in a way that I think is just really fascinating. And then, of course, I also saw Hamilton that week. So for me, it was just a 1-2-3 punch of reinterpreting stuff that we already thought that we knew so that we can look back at it with a different viewpoint and look ahead at, you know, what could happen next.
How great is Hamilton, by the way?
that's another one I'll never see. Oh my gosh, somebody's got to do that at the high school in my town.
You
can't, or something.
You need to get out more.
I got three little kids. I don't have much of a social life these days, unless it's like Cub Scouts related. So so I want to finish up. Our last question today is really just pure speculation, but, you know, Heidi said, where's the ninth book? And Tracy was talking about how theater allows you to revisit stories and to tell them over and to do cultural memory work. So now the big question is, do you think J.K. Rowling might actually do some playwriting or do some more playwriting, depending on what you thought about the last question? Do you think we'll get another sequel? I would love to see a prequel. Do we think that she's going to be doing more plays based on Harry Potter? What do you guys think? Let's see. I'll throw it out to Elspeth first.
I think Harry's story is done, and you can tell that it's done because Cursed Child wasn't actually about Harry Potter. That well has been run dry. Honestly, I'd like to see more of the Wizarding World. I'd like to see what comes next with Fantastic Beasts. Uh-huh. I think that's a you know, wealth of untapped stories that could, like, handled properly, could be really, really good. I think the idea that, you know, this is where we're approaching the end of Harry Potter is ludicrous, because, you know, Star Wars is still going on. And Disney World is still going on, so I don't think we're getting to the end of it. I think basically at the end of the day, what people want is good stories told well, and if we can get more of those, then, you know, keep them coming.
Yeah, I'm excited for more Fantastic Beasts, I must say. I loved the first film, and I can't wait for the second one.
I'm excited for that, too. I'd really love something with, you know, with the Marauders. That's what I'm looking for, a Marauder story of some kind, maybe told on the play, on the stage. What do you think, Heidi?
Well, I think at this point, we don't know where the Fantastic Beasts series is going to end up, what year, what, you know, what era. So are we going to hit into, you know, the early 1970s? Are we going to get Marauder era? Are we just going to, you know, get their, you know, various random parents? Are we going to get, you know, Sirius's uncle and stuff like that? Various Crouches. You know, I want to get that far.
Yeah, don't you think it'll like that will like turn into Star Wars prequel territory though? It's just like, did you know that this incidental character actually has this enormous backstory now? And you just like, I don't want that magic of, you know, having a character called Deedliest Diggle to be ruined. To know that, you know, actually he was a super secret Bosnian spy. I just want him to be called Deedliest Diggle. I think, yeah, no, I mean, that's, I have some opinions on the idea of prequels.
Less is more, maybe. Less is more. What do you think, Tracy? Do we have more stage plays in our Harry Potter future?
Well, if I could just put in a small plug for a definitely non-canonical stage play that's currently running off-Broadway called Puffs, a play for anyone who has never been destined to save the world. And it tells the story of the seven novels from the perspective of a bunch of nameless Hufflepuffs.
Oh, wonderful.
Nice. Fabulous.
It is adorable and fantastic.
Yes. Obviously, it can't use a lot of names, any names at all, but I think it's another example of the way people who love this material and understand it on a real emotional level can have fun with it. And I mean, I think it's probably sadly inevitable we're going to get a movie of Cursed Child and then probably a musical based on the movie of Cursed Child. You know?
It'll be 12 hours then.
Exactly. But I mean, I'm just kind of happy to be here and to see what happens next.
Well, I think we have to hope. We have to think that Broadway is hoping that there will be more Cursed Child plays, because this, in its preview week, has broken all sorts of earnings records for Broadway.
It just opened on Sunday. It's getting rave reviews from the time.
That's right. And really, if there's an upside to Cursed Child, and I'm looking hard for the silver lining here, other than you know, all of you are talking about this 1,600 people event, and that's really what I think it is an event, you know, Harry Potter fandom event. But what it really does is people coming to see live theater, people that are absolutely, you know, unfamiliar with this, people that are much more likely to have gone to Orlando than to the West End, are now coming for theater and getting their experience of it. And I think they're going to want to see Hamilton. They're going to want to see Mean Girls. They're going to see Puffs. They're going to be excited about that experience that they had, which is absolutely singular in the art world. I mean, as Tracy pointed out, it's not even in the Wizarding world. And a lot of Wizarding World fandom people have never been to this world. So that's the most exciting thing for me, is that Cursed Child is opening up an entirely different experience to large parts of Harry Potter fandom, which can only be good.
Agreed.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree too. I'm just, I liked how Tracy, you said, I'm just happy to be here. Like, I do feel like that. Like, it's just really exciting to see all this stuff happening in the Harry Potter world. Well, I'm sorry to say that we are pretty far out of time, actually, but we had such a great conversation that I wanted to make sure that we kept it going there. And so I want to thank everybody. Thank you very much, Heidi Tandy, Tracy Beeler, Elspeth Gordon-Smith, and Dolores Gordon-Smith. And be sure to check out Dolores's mystery series. I was just telling her how much I had enjoyed it when I did my little foray into it. If you like classic English mysteries, it's great. It's exactly the kind of thing you would see on your PBS mystery show. So
thank you.
Thanks also to John Granger, of course, for being our continuing expert guest. You and I were sitting on the sidelines for my guest, John, because we're just, you know, imbibing what they're telling us about their experience. But wow, it sounds like this play is just a fantastic experience.
Well, I want to say first, I would apologize to everybody here for saying anything in this conversation because I haven't seen the play. And I also want to, on top of my apology, I want to thank you because I'm actually pretty excited about going to see this thing now.
You should be. I mean, I think hopefully by the end of this, like anybody listening, you definitely go and see Cursed Child if you can.
Oh, yeah.
Because you need to experience it for yourself.
Yeah. Can I just throw in a remark, though, about if anyone's coming across to London and they want to do the studio tour?
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, because... This is really important to know. When you go in the studios, you're left very much to your own devices, which is great. You've got as much time as you want to wander around. But it's split into two separate sound stages. The vast majority of the objects to look at and the things to do is on the first sound stage, because that's where the vast majority of the stuff is. I mean, on the second sound stage, there's the absolutely knockout model of Hogwarts, which you can look at for ages, but yeah, stick with the first sound stage as long as you can.
You know, they are these almost communal rituals, even pilgrimages. I saw a presentation at the National Pop Culture Conference about Harry Potter pilgrimages, and that these are ways that we're reinvesting in the meaning of the books for ourselves. I'd also like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you, Emma. You always do such a great job editing our podcast. And of course, we appreciate our partners very much at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. So, dear listeners, if you would like to contact us, you can send us an email at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us on Read, Write, Roll. We also have a Facebook page, so you can like our Facebook page. And we've got a little discussion going on right now about whether the Harry Potter books are classic literature or not. Now, listeners, I normally leave you with the words of wisdom from Hogwarts headmaster Albus Dumbledore. But today, as a reminder of all the things that must come together to produce great theater, and how things can go spectacularly wrong, especially with high-tech theatrical productions, I thought I would remind you of Professor Dumbledore's description of the time Hogwarts students performed a pantomime of Beedle the Bard's story, The Fountain of Fair Fortune. And here's Dumbledore's kind of conclusion about how the performance went. He said, "The night's entertainment concluded with a packed hospital wing. It was several months before the Great Hall lost its pungent aroma of wood smoke, and even longer before Professor Beery's head reassumed its normal proportions and Professor Kettleburn was taken off probation. Headmaster Armando Dippet imposed a blanket ban on future pantomimes, a proud non-theatrical tradition that Hogwarts continues to this day." So much for theater in the wizarding world. But really, I leave you with this great saying from Albus Dumbledore. He said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." And so we'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.